You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Neanderthal DNA can help us better understand our own health. A paleoanthropologist joins us to talk about the latest research. Now, colleges around Wisconsin are trying to figure out how to get more students. National student turnout has surged over the last couple elections. It's not clear if that trend will continue, and advocates say barriers in states like Wisconsin can make it harder for students to cast their ballots. Our next guest is part of an effort to address some of the barriers colleges have control over, including being too busy to vote. He's part of a coalition of private colleges and universities across the state that are canceling classes on Election Day in an effort to make it easier for students to vote. Ron Watson is an associate professor of political science and health and society at Beloit College, one of the people behind the campaign Why Bother Wisconsin. Ron, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us why Beloit College is joining other private institutions around the state in canceling classes on Election Day?
Well, our hope, of course, is that we can move to help students make voting a lifelong habit. And I think that all of us recognize today, especially those in higher education, that American democracy is facing some of its greatest challenges, certainly that I've seen in my lifetime, and I think most people have seen in theirs. And so in that sense, we really are hoping that young people will tune into to voting and make it something that they do from here on out.
Can you talk about some of the barriers that students might face when they're trying to cast their ballots?
Absolutely. Well, one of the things that I think a number of students have to deal with is their IDs. For some schools, they are required to have a specific voter ID. And some of the schools in Wisconsin are able to produce that. We're fortunate at Beloit that our student ID does seem to be in compliance with the law in terms of what's necessary. But again, many students across the state maybe face this as a barrier. Some of the other things are even things like work. Any number of students have to work, and they have to work to put themselves through school. And so in that sense, anything that we can do, including moving our schedules around so that we can either reduce or cancel classes on Election Day, will help to get them to the polls.
The issue of classes on Election Day is just one part of the campaign. You're also reaching out to students. The name itself, Why Bother Wisconsin, suggests that you're hoping to overcome any apathy or reluctance to vote. Can you talk about that side of the campaign?
Well, absolutely. So we've been trying to run a number of different events to raise awareness about voting on campus. But we know that students often, especially when we're young, we often have the sense that voting doesn't matter. And in fact, we've had some conversations with a couple of students here fairly recently in which they've expressed sort of their concern about the idea of voting itself, including that they just don't feel that any of the candidates represent them, or that they are worried that if they vote for one particular candidate, that they'll have sort of buyer's remorse around it. And what we're hoping is through some of these events is just to get people talking about this, because this is an understandable concern. But we hope that students will come away understanding that the most important thing is to contribute to the functioning of our democracy, because the alternative is certainly something that they would not want to experience.
And you're also thinking, I think, about wider issues of civic engagement. Can you talk about what you might be talking about with students beyond casting the ballot itself?
Well, this is one of the pieces here, right, is I think that to make civic engagement a lifelong activity, right? Voting, of course, is simply part of that. But we want students to get out and to get their not only get out to vote themselves, but to encourage their family members, to encourage other students to vote, but also to be active in speaking with and communicating with their elected officials and those who are running for office. I mean, in fact, we are holding a candidate forum here on Thursday on campus, where we're hoping that students will come out and really ask some tough questions of the candidates.
Beloit College is in this. I think eight private colleges and universities around the state are involved. What would you say to your colleagues at other institutions that haven't gotten on board to encourage them to do something like this Why Bother Wisconsin campaign?
Well, I think the one thing that I would say is that ultimately we all want to live in a country that has a democracy and that values democratic governance. And to the extent that civics education has really taken a beating at the secondary level, we're hoping that colleges and universities will step up recognize that we are sort of one of the last areas where young people can really become educated in how to be citizens and what it means to be a citizen in a democracy. And I think even if they aren't able to create a day off, because we know in higher education how precious that time is, even if they can't do that, there are a variety of other events and other ways to incentivize students to be involved in the political process. And I hope our other institutions across the state will take that to heart.
And that's higher education. Would you hope that, you know, employers and others would also do something similar to help people participate on Election Day?
Oh my goodness, that would be the absolute ideal, isn't it? Wouldn't it be, right? Because I think we have to all recognize that taking part in this democracy is everyone's responsibility, right? It's not just the responsibility of elementary schools or high schools or colleges and universities, but every person in our society who values what it means to live under a democratic government has to take it as a responsibility. I mean, I have to tell you, over the years, I have heard any number of folks say, for example, they couldn't go to work. And I'm not talking about just students, but they had to go to work to vote or instead of voting, or they couldn't go to work because they had to vote. And there shouldn't be that sort of conflict. Taking part in our governance is critical to who we are as people. And you know, it seems to me that it makes sense for even companies to join in on this kind of movement.
And obviously, I imagine you've got your eyes on the midterm elections next month for the project. What's next after that?
Well, we hope to keep the momentum going into April, right? Because we know there's some important state Supreme Court related elections happening then. So, and then of course, having our eyes ever forward to the 2024 election. It's important for us to, again, build up the momentum and find the best practices that will get students out and engaged in our political process.
Ron, thanks again for joining us today.
Not at all. Thank you.
That's Ron Watson, Associate Professor of Political Science at Beloit College, with us today to talk about an effort to make voting easier for college students. This is a partnership of private colleges and universities around the state. It's called Why Bother Wisconsin. It includes canceling or limiting classes on Election Day, among other things. You can find more info about it at WPR.org/Central Time. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Carl Christensen with a story about a parent's business.
Running a family business can instill pride and a valuable work ethic that circulates through the household. Wisconsin writer Nancy Jorgensen shares a story about growing up around her father's printing business and its lasting impact on future generations of the family.
My dad's work shirts, button-down, short-sleeved, white or blue, smelled like ink. The scent radiated, faint each morning when he wore a clean one, heavy in the evenings after a day in the shop. When ink dries, it releases the scent of aldehydes, ketones, and carboxylic acids. To me, it was the aroma of security, pride, and hard work. My dad birthed his offset printing company the same year I was born, in 1954, when paper companies and print shops flourished in Wisconsin. During the day, he ran jobs in another printer's shop, and in the evenings, he operated his own press. He worked from our basement, where paper and color became brochures, pamphlets, and books. While my mother fed and tended to me, he nurtured his other baby. Like twins, the business and I grew together. Within a few years, my dad quit his day job and bought more presses, cameras, a cutter, folder, stitcher, and drill. He mortgaged a building and created a press room, darkroom, bindery, and office. He stocked paper, glue, and ink. An entrepreneur, he grew a business alongside his family, and soon I had a brother and sister. The business sent my siblings and me to college, and in the summer between semesters, I worked in the bindery. My fingers studied the sensations of gloss, matte, and silk. My arms weighed the difference between a newspaper and the sheets of a magazine. As ideas and information became leaflets and publications, I inhaled the chemicals straight from their ink-soaked pages. My dad chose a business for the future, a legacy for our family, a product that would always be in demand. Didn't every college need a course brochure? Didn't every auction need a catalog? Didn't every city need a wall calendar? He paid a fair wage to salesmen, pressmen, cameramen, and secretaries. and he carved room in the budget for donations to local schools, to the Park and Recreation Department, to the Schoenstatt sisters, in their long black habits, who needed materials for their retreats. My dad died before the collapse of Wisconsin's printing industry. Confident, he left my brother a profitable legacy. But when colleges and auctions and city governments moved information online, and print shops around the state folded, my brother said, Dad would want me to face reality and make tough choices. My grandson Stanley, 2.5 years of age, learns songs from YouTube. He pinches a screen to watch a favorite show. He shouts at the alarm on my phone, Hey Google, stop! He is a child of Wi-Fi, of FaceTime, of Instagram, of Twitter, and his parents buy more broadband than number two pencils, more 4G than spiral notebooks. But when Stanley is tired, he offers me his favorite book. Grandma, read. He strokes the fur on a page about animals. He screams siren sounds at a page about fire trucks. He sniffs the image of a rose on a page about flowers. When Stanley is older, I will show him my drawer full of his great-grandpa's work. Covers and insides, shiny and black, or clean and white, or textured and variegated. Relics of a not-so-long-ago time and a man who made an imprint.
That was writer and Waukesha native Nancy Jorgensen. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
Coming up, new research tells us how the Neanderthal genome can tell us about our own health. A Wisconsin researcher takes us on a journey tens of thousands of years in the making. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Swedish scientist Svante Paabo was awarded the Nobel Prize in Medicine for his work deciphering the Neanderthal genome. His research provided new information about Neanderthal culture and society and info that can teach us, humans living thousands of years after Neanderthals, about our own health. John Hawks is a paleoanthropologist and distinguished achievement professor in anthropology at UW-Madison. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
First, can you situate Neanderthals in our family tree, which changes over time, sometimes with new information? How are they related to us?
Sure. Neanderthals are a group of people who lived between about 450,000 years ago and about 40,000 years ago in the western half of Eurasia, broadly put. And they are the most numerous fossil representative of the human lineage. They are the most recent extinct members of our lineage, and they're ones that we know the most about.
Now, a lot of our conversation today is about their DNA. And you just said 40,000 years ago. How hard is it to get useful DNA profiles of someone that lived 40,000 years ago?
You know, it's really remarkable. When I was a student in the 1990s, I used to tell people, this is never going to be possible. And, you know, Jurassic Park was a thing. So people were curious, you know, is it possible to get genetic information from the past? There were many, many barriers to it. DNA breaks down over time. And it's a chemical. It's a tough chemical. It can last in your body and after you die for some period of time. But it inevitably breaks down into really, really tiny fragments. It was the technical advances of, you know, really the years from 2000 to 2010 in which our methods of sequencing genetics began to rely on an approach that was breaking down people's DNA into tiny fragments and sequencing them all, that shotgun sequencing approach that made people able to take tiny fragments of DNA from ancient sites and do anything with them at all. Today, it is, you know, I wouldn't say routine, but with very specialized laboratories and approaches, it's possible to get genetic evidence out of 40,000, 100,000-year-old fossils that are as good a quality as we can get from living people.
And then did I see this study that just came out? Was this over the weekend? We have what might be a whole family or at least a closely connected community of Neanderthals. We've got their DNA now.
This is really a fascinating story for me. This is a cave in southern Russia, in Siberia, where there are tiny bone fragments from an archaeological layer that dates to somewhere around 45,000 50,000 to 60,000 years ago. And those tiny bone fragments now, every single one of them has had DNA application to it. And they were able to uncover that some of them were tiny fragments of a single individual. There was a pair of a tiny piece of vertebra and a tooth that were the father and his daughter. There were others that were aunt and nephew or second order relatives of that kind. So that picture of a Neanderthal group made up of, I think, 15 individuals, where you can see the kinship among them, gives us a picture of a past society that would have been totally impossible to imagine 10, 15 years ago.
Talking to John Hawks, paleoanthropologist at UW-Madison, talking about Neanderthal DNA, how we're extracting it, using it, finding stuff out about it, and what it means for our health today. And let's get into that. This is cool in and of itself, but also we can learn lessons about our DNA and its relation to our health now?
Yeah, that's exactly right. One of the really, just profound things that was learned from getting the genomes of these ancient people is that there are very, very few things that make us different from them. You know, we have their DNA today in a small fraction. You know, you and I are something like 2%. We can trace our ancestry to this ancient group. They're not really extinct in that sense, right? We are their descendants. The genes that we got from them are still in our genomes doing stuff. And it's possible to study today tens of thousands of people and look at them and see, okay, the people that carry this Neanderthal gene here, how are they different from the ones who don't have that? There are several genes that impact human immunity and human responses to viruses that, for example, that are from Neanderthals. With COVID-19, Svante's group, the Nobel Prize winner, found that there is a genetic variant that's relatively common in Northern Europe that increases susceptibility to severe COVID, right? People who get that severe COVID hospitalization, they're more likely to carry this variant. With other things, we think that the Neanderthal variation may actually improve matters, may give us resistance to things that today, you know, are a problem for people. There's no predicting, right? It's not like all the Neanderthal stuff is good or all the Neanderthal stuff is bad. But understanding the evolutionary history of these particular gene variants gives us a way of looking at the variations today and understanding why they're different and where they came from.
Now, I saw recently a more recent example during the Great Black Death of the 1300s.
Yeah.
Some people had a better chance of surviving if they had a gene that apparently may contribute to Crohn's disease today.
Mm-hmm.
Good then, bad now. Are we going to be finding more examples of that, maybe from the Neanderthal era, and maybe even reverse engineering it and figuring out these are the diseases that afflicted them back then?
You know, some of the major health challenges today, like Crohn's disease, are autoimmune diseases. And we know that the immune system is an adaptive system within our bodies that's responding to the environments we're exposed to. Today's environments are different from the environments of past people in lots of ways. And one of the biggest ways is that with sanitation, with improved cleanliness, right, the way that we have modern life, it's removing many things that past peoples would have been exposed to early in their lives, you know, worms and parasites and bacteria, right, that were once ubiquitous in environments, today we're not exposed to as much. There's a major line of thought about autoimmune disease is that actually this is on the increase because we are changing environments in this way. And so understanding how these genes were active in past environments and the things that they actually helped to adapt people to survive, that can give us some clues about the biological mechanisms that we might be able to tweak today to make a difference to some of these conditions.
Now, Neanderthals are one of our relatives. They're not the only relative of ours from the past. Is there hope that we'll be getting usable DNA from other parts of, I don't know if the family tree is the right word anymore, but of our heritage there?
That's exactly right. You know, we today are able to get DNA most easily out of sites that have a relatively cold annual temperature. And that's why there's a real bias in our recovery of DNA from Europe, from parts of Asia that are sort of not tropical Asia, northern Asia. And where I work in southern Africa, it is right now not possible to get DNA from these ancient time periods. And it's because of the temperature and because of the preservation environment. there is hope that new technologies will give us access to even tinier fragments of DNA, or that we'll find situations in which it happens to be preserved more. But another way of looking at the past is by sampling ancient proteins. And we're very interested in that in my team working in Southern Africa now. We're finding protein that is preserved in teeth that can be millions of years old. And that's going to give us some information. It's not as much as having a genome that has 6 billion base pairs of information. You know, proteins are relatively small compared to that, but it still may tell us some interesting clues about how these different species are connected to each other.
Could that kind of thing give us a sense of what people say ate or the kind of diseases they got those proteins?
Yeah. So with the teeth, one of the biggest clues that we get from it is the things that actually affect teeth. Mm-hmm. And one of the most promising avenues of information today about past peoples is actually sampling the outsides of their teeth. The calculus that forms on your teeth, right? If you go to the dentist and get this scraped off, right, it's tartar, and we do tartar control to try to take it off, right? For paleontologists, that is the most amazing thing because it actually, I mean, it's kind of gross, but it's preserving tiny pieces of plants, it's preserving bacteria, and it's preserving the DNA of the individuals and also their microbiome. And we are getting more and more information out of that source.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's John Hawks, paleoanthropologist and distinguished achievement professor in anthropology at UW-Madison. He joined us today to look at Neanderthal DNA, which we can find and test and analyze, and why it matters for our health today, 2022. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, trace the journey of African cooking to the United States with the author of the book High on the Hog, A Culinary Journey from Africa to America. That author giving a talk, by the way, coming up at UW-Stevens Point. And WPR music host Sheila Shigley from Simply Folk joins the show with some great seasonal and holiday music recommendations. She's going to have some samples for us to share. Maybe you can call in with your own suggestions. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll explore the latest retail trends with customers shifting back away from online shopping and toward more brick and mortar in-person stores. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a CDC advisory group is recommending the COVID vaccine be added to immunization schedules. We'll learn more about what impact that could have and look at some of the misinformation surrounding that decision. First, the pandemic forced a lot of people to change their shopping habits and make more of their purchases online instead of in-store. Some business analysts wondered if that change was going to become permanent as more people tried out online shopping for the first time. Turns out as the threat of the pandemic wound down, so did some of that online spending. Data from the U.S. Census Bureau shows that the growth of online sales was slowing down, while overall retail sales have continued to go up. That trend could shape the way businesses approach their retail operations in the future, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. How much of your shopping do you do in-store versus online? Did the pandemic change how you shop? If so, have you changed back? What are you doing differently? What are you doing the same? Call 800-642-1234. Tell us how you buy your stuff. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Hart Posen is a professor of management and human resources at the UW-Madison School of Business and an expert on business strategy. Hart, welcome back to not just Central Time, to the studio.
It's so good to be back.
It's been a while.
With you. It's great.
Got the band back together.
All right.
Now, we were talking, not in the studio, early in the pandemic, a lot of people new to online shopping. The big question mark was, is that going to stick? Are we training people? Are people picking up this habit? They're going to stick with it. Bad news for online stores. What are you looking at today?
Well, the habit is still growing, but in fact, we're gone back to growing at the pace we did before the pandemic. So when the pandemic hit, there was this big upward spike in online shopping for obvious reasons. But now if you look at the trend from before the pandemic, we've gone back down to that old trend line pretty much. So pretty much the pandemic effect on e-commerce overall was transitory. It went away, but we're still buying more and more online every year.
But it's that slow, gradual growth we saw before we heard of this pandemic, not that like exponential growth we saw during it.
That's exactly right. And this varies by sectors. For different sectors, the change has been different. But yes.
And one of the charts I saw with this census data was clothing sector. And man, oh man, and that it looks like we're exactly where we were before pandemic. We bought stuff online. We were apparently happy to do it, but I guess we're happier to go to a store and buy our clothes.
Well, yeah, you see this in a couple of ways. If you look at other data for clothing retail, you'll find that, in fact, clothing was one of the hardest categories hit by the pandemic. In terms of total dollar volume, after the pandemic eased off, retail sales of clothing skyrocketed and went back down. You know, there was a lot of pent-up demand for clothing. But part of it is we want to go to the store and try it on. And the data across very different segments, one piece of data I've seen recently, is maybe up to 2/3 of people or more want to go and try it on.
Now, one part of this story, too, was your online companies, Amazon in particular, really muscled up, hired people. Where I go to my grocery store, there were traffic jams because across the street was an Amazon distribution and all these Prime trucks going around. Concern now, I think, in the markets that they may have overdeveloped their facilities, their staffing, given what we're looking at now.
Well, Amazon has been hard hit lately. Their stock has dropped by about a third since its peak, and they are scaling back on hiring. They're scaling back on some of the growth rate and distribution infrastructure, and we're starting to observe that. But don't think for a second that means anything negative for Amazon.
Right, they're not going to go away tomorrow.
Certainly not.
We're talking to Hart Posen from the UW-Madison School of Business, looking at how we buy things. The pandemic, online shopping went up a lot. Now we're seeing retail stores not doing so bad. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Want to hear your shopping evolution over the last couple of years? That's 800-642-1234. Joe joins us now in Lake Geneva. Joe, hi.
Hey, I just wanted to mention the fact that I actually prefer shopping in person now, just on account of the fact that, like, with a lot of Amazon deliveries and stuff are being stolen, and so it just, like, kind of takes that aspect out of the equation,
Yeah. And Joe, I want to ask, did you, at any point during the pandemic, were you working from home, or were you in a job where that wasn't an option?
No, I've never had the option to work at home, no.
Okay, Joe, thanks a lot for bringing that up. I bring that up, Hart, because I think what the retail theft thing was, if I'm working at home all the time, I'm there when that package shows up. Porch Pirates, sorry, I'm bringing it in before you get there. If people like Joe never got to work at home, or people are going from home back to the office, maybe that worry is there about what happens to that package while I'm waiting to get home from work.
Yeah, and folks have been trying to solve that in many ways, right? So our doorbell cameras have some effect, obviously, but Amazon has partnered, for instance, with one of the garage door firms that sell a product called MyQ that allows their drivers, you can opt to give their drivers access to your garage. And so folks are trying to solve it, but that problem will never go away fully, right?
Joe, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Let's get back to my grocery shopping experience, Hart, because people
Absolutely.
Love to hear about that. A change happened. I often go in off hours to my big grocery store, and there's me and some other shoppers and then a bunch of store staff rounding up the groceries that somebody else ordered online. Can you talk about the ways the shopping experience, when you're going to a store, has changed over the last couple of years?
Well, these grocery stores had, one of the most interesting things about the pandemic is it created this window of opportunity for folks in many industries, but retail in particular, to experiment. Things they would have rolled out slowly over many years and tried in a couple of stores to see how it worked, they had no choice but to roll it out rapidly. And one of the things that gets rolled out is, whether it's a third party like Instacart or it's the store's own folks, using the stores as warehouses. And, you know, the way I talk about online retail versus in-person retail is in-person retail is designed to be a self-service warehouse, and online retail is a full-service warehouse, right? You go to this, it's self-service in the sense that, you know, Rob drives to the store, he parks his car, he gets a cart, he pulls his own stuff, puts it in the cart, carries it to the checkout, carries it out to his car. And of course, online eliminates that task for you. But now what happens, I think your point is, what happens when they're not just using that store as a self-service warehouse, but using it as a full-service warehouse as well, with people with carts in the aisle professionally picking stuff? Mm-hmm. And guess what? It doesn't work very well. It doesn't work very well for the shoppers in the store, because Rob's being pushed out of the way by someone with a cart and a computer and a long list. And in fact, it doesn't work very well as an e-commerce platform, even though its feature is it's close to the customers. But you never quite know what's in stock in the store, because it might say there are three in the store, but three customers have them in their cart walking to the checkout. So sometimes stuff is in the store that you're not going to be able to buy online. Sometimes the stuff you want isn't there, and there's no means to tell you, here's a good substitute. Mm-hmm. There are all these problems with it. And so what folks are doing, in particular, this is true for Walmart, but I think for others as well, is, you know, for years they've been getting rid of the back room in their stores to make more shopping space. Mm-hmm. They're slowly putting some back room back so that they can use the proximity to their customers but have a separate storage area for a lot of items, because you don't want those people in the aisles. Mm-hmm. And so it was a real, really interesting period of experimentation where we learned a lot.
We're talking about retail online and in person with UW-Madison Business School professor Hart Posen. Online, of course, big in the early days of the pandemic. It's scaled back. Some people are getting back into stores for in-store shopping, even though it's changed in some ways. And we want to hear you at 800-642-1234. Did the pandemic cause any lasting changes in the way you shop? Did you become more willing to buy things online and have them shipped to you? Were there certain things that you still want to go into a store to buy in person? If you work in retail at a Amazon facility, say, or in a big box store or in a small retail store, what has changed in your work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with UW-Madison Business School professor Hart Posen with us today, looking at the latest trend in retail sales, shifting away from online shopping after a big jump early in the pandemic back toward physical stores. And we want to hear your own story at 800-642-1234. Did your shopping habits change early in the pandemic? Have those changes stuck, or did you go back? Do you do some kind of hybrid thing, order something online, pick it up at a store? Do you work in retail? Did you work in retail and you left it during all of this? Tell us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Labor shortages affecting everything, lots of lines of work. How has retail dealt with this?
This has been obviously really, really challenging broadly across retail, including obviously restaurants and other things. And boy, you see this in terms of, you know, we were at going someplace recently, and on the sign, the door said closed because they didn't have any staff. I think so we know where things stood and the rate at which, you know, retailers had to increase wages. At the Target I go to, they had a sign, try and hire. And you could watch every few months starting salary number go up and up and up. I think the big question in everyone's mind now is what will be the implications of the recent increases, substantial increases in interest rates on that. And I think one hypothesis is that those those shortages will be diminished as people feel pressure to come back into the workforce.
Now, one newer wrinkle than our earliest conversations about all this, Hart, is inflation sticking around for a while. Are you seeing that? Are we stopping buying stuff? Are we cutting back on things? It doesn't seem like the numbers show that.
They don't show it yet, but you know, you should keep in mind that the Fed's goal, the Federal Reserve Bank, it is to slow consumer spending to cool down the economy. Mm-hmm. So, one take on it is the rates will keep on going up until they feel their interest rate effect interventions bite on, amongst other things, consumer sales, consumer spending.
I mean, it seems like at some point we're going to have the Federal Reserve chair showing up in front of my local store trying to stop me getting in the door.
That's a nice image. You ought to draw a cartoon of that. That's good. Now, I like that.
On a more serious note, like over the last couple of years, some stores have closed. Smaller stores or chains have closed down. How much has gone away over the course of the pandemic?
You know, I don't have those specific numbers on me, but I think that in many sectors, yes, a lot of stuff has gone away, but a lot of new stuff has popped up. Mm-hmm. And I think one way to think about this is that those businesses that were the most borderline to start with were obviously the most vulnerable. And as many of them quickly got swept away at the start of the pandemic. And clearly for those families that own those kinds of businesses, this is a tragedy. But as those firms got swept away, they've been replaced by others. And so you see certain regional and local restaurant chains growing. You see a lot of that. You know, I think we should never forget that every time one firm goes away, something else comes in to take its place. And we may like it, we might not like it, but this is the process by which the economy finds new kinds of businesses and new kinds of enterprises and new kinds of products. And our economy over the last century has been very, very good at doing this.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us calling from upstate New York. Jim, hi.
Hi there. Hey, how's it going?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Jim?
Well, I'll tell you what. This is a fascinating program. First of all, we're addicted to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Great.
And I come at this from a couple of different perspectives. One is that my family and I, of course, like everybody else, pretty much relied on online ordering and buying during the pandemic, but also from the perspective of an architect who designs retail stores all over the country, for that matter. And of course, that portion of my business somewhat disappeared for a few months, but it came back. It's come roaring back, frankly. And a lot of it is, I said to your producer, we moved from a very large city to a very small village. And part of it is because we love that interaction between ourselves and the person behind the counter, as well as running into other people. And that's part of, I really missed that part. We lived in Minneapolis for many years, and to run into friends and so on in the various stores. And we missed that. And I think I see that coming back in a lot of people. And I think a lot of people are feeling guilty about their downtowns kind of turning into nothing and realize that they are the answer. And it's been very interesting.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Hart, you're nodding along there.
Yeah, no, I fully agree. If you go back to the late 1990s and the early 2000s, you saw people talking about how maybe eventually one day online will replace stores. This mentality went on until maybe about 8, 7, 6 years ago, where folks started to think more richly about something we now call omnichannel retailing. There'll be many different points of contact. And the idea that a store is not a substitute, or online retail is not a substitute for physical retail, but a complement to. And I think the trick, as if it were easy to do, for these retailers is to find a store configuration that can make this work. So there's recently news from Macy's, the department store, and they found that for years they had been reducing stores, but they found a significant complementarity. Where they had stores, their online retail was most productive. They're not substitutes, they're complements. And just this social interaction in the physical stores, it's not just trying stuff on, but social interaction, which is innate to our human character, is clearly very important. And you know, you commented that you're a retail architect. Boy, you folks are important now, because now we have to figure out a whole bunch of new things, not just what the front of the store looks like, but what the back of the store looks like to facilitate that complementarity between e-commerce and physical stores to make it work really well.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking about the recent past, the present, and future of how we shop online versus in person. Online came on strong for a while there. In person, doing pretty good now, it looks like. So time for you to call, if you call quickly, at 800-642-1234. Hart, what are you watching for next? What are some of the big open questions for you right now?
I the thing that interests me most is to see which of these experiments that were undertaken during COVID stick around. The most notable one for me, because I go to a Target that's not too far from my house, is, and many places have it, these parking spots in front for in-store pickup. And the question is, how will this in-store pickup be done? To what extent are they able to rework that store to create inventory that's for the online, that doesn't interfere with the storefront shopping experience? And you know, the Target and others went to that store pickup very fast, but I don't think the way we see it now is the way it's going to be, or the way it's going to look in 3 years or 5 years. And I'm very interested to see how that changes.
Interesting. We've got time for one more caller, actually. Randy is with us in Ripon. Randy, hi.
Hi. I just kind of wanted to back up the last caller. I used to, back in the 70s and 80s, when we had all these catalogs in order, and I went back to my local stores as well as, well, you know, you got to go to the big box, but I prefer the small business owner, the small lumber yard. I like, to me, service has value. It isn't just price, it's the service I get. To me, that has means something. So that's all I had to say.
Randy, thanks a lot. I don't think that's uncommon, Hart. How can that smaller business owner in particular tap into that sentiment from Randy?
Well, you know, I think they're working very hard at it, but I guess what I would add to what Randy said, because I agree with him, is that many large retailers are also recognizing that service matters. And there are different types. There are Walmarts where service is not a big thing, but there is Costco where I think if you're a Costco shop, you'd recognize that the kind of service you get there is important as well. So I think it's important, not only for small local retailers, but I think it's important for many large established retailers as well. And I for one, am willing to pay for service. And so I fully agree with the caller.
Thanks a lot for that call. Hart, in just our last minute or so, do you think that steady climb, not that huge jump we saw, that steady climb in online will probably continue into the future?
Absolutely, because the best retailers are trying to figure out how to make this complementarity between e-commerce and physical stores work. We are going to see a bigger presence in physical stores of online retailers. They're going to do more and more of it. And that climb will continue, but we will never see a world where it's 100% e-commerce or not even close.
Hart, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Great to be back.
That's Hart Posen, professor of management and human resources at the UW-Madison School of Business, with us today to talk about consumer behavior trends and an apparent shift in retail. The online surge early in the pandemic, well, people are going back to in-stores a lot more. Still time for you to share your thoughts, your shopping experiences, by the way, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a Wisconsin public health doctor about the COVID-19 vaccine being added to the recommended immunization schedule. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.